now, Flashpoint.
Today on Flashpoints, we'll speak to Daryl Cherney and Mary Liz Thompson, the producer and director of the brand new film, Who Bombed Judy Berry? The film about the life and times of Judy Berry, who was car bombed in Oakland in 1990.
I heard a crack, and then my whole head started to ring like a sitar in my head, like, and the car came to a screeching halt. The first thought in my mind was, oh no, not again. Because last August we had been rear-ended by a log truck without ever seeing it coming. And here we are again, me and Judy in a car. And then I heard somebody scream out, it's a bomb. There was a bomb. And then it all made sense that someone had tried to kill us.
Daryl Cherney, you'll hear more from him. He'll be joining us. We'll also be joined by Earth First activist and longtime friend Karen Pickett, and we'll explore the ongoing investigation as Judy Berry's bomber still roams freely. I'm Dennis Bernstein. All this straight ahead on Flashpoint. Stay tuned. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Legendary Earth First organizer and car bomb victim Judy Berry may have passed away in 1997, but on the 15th anniversary of her death, a 93-minute documentary, Who Bombed Judy Berry, produced by her Echo cohort, Daryl Cherney, will premiere at the San Francisco Green Film Festival this Friday, March 2nd. The film is directed by Mary Liz Thompson, and it is based entirely on archival footage, including Judy Berry's inspirational speeches, colorful and daring Redwood protests, etc. Who Bombed Judy Berry is actually narrated by Judy Berry herself, using footage taken at her deathbed testimony in her successful civil rights lawsuit against the FBI and the Oakland police. By the way, they blamed her and Daryl Cherney for bombing themselves. We're delighted to be joined now by Daryl Cherney and Mary Liz Thompson. Daryl and Mary Liz, welcome to Flashpoints, and we're all celebrating the release of this film and the ongoing battle, shall we say, to track down and figure out who the real murderer, and I say that word murderer because they gave her a slow-motion death of Judy Berry. Daryl, thanks for being with us. Mary Liz, thanks for being with us.
Always a pleasure, Dennis.
Yeah.
All right. Well, where to start? Maybe we should start with a very sort of pragmatic upfront question. Why do you think, Daryl, it's important 22 years after the bombing of Judy Berry to tell the story? Why does it remain relevant?
Well, the movie has four essential purposes. The first is to educate on tactics and strategy. And we think nobody in the movement was superior in these arenas than Judy Berry. Just a razor sharp mind and wit. And she could really come up with solutions quickly. And this movie is filled with victories, major victories of saving forests, of taking on the FBI, of getting people to quit their jobs. In other words, in a movement where sometimes defeat is the norm, I think it's refreshing to have a movie that shows victory. Judy was a radical. I think she will appeal to young people as well as to our elders. And the second purpose of our movie is to inspire action. And Judy Barry's speeches always inspired action, and to this extent, we are bringing her back to life. Her speeches are as relevant today and as inspirational today as they always have been. The third reason for the movie is to educate people as to who the historical figure Judy Barry is. And I don't think it's ever too late to learn about who our heroes can be, especially women heroes, who I prefer to call sheroes. And Judy Barry needs to have her place in history. And the fourth reason is that this case is an unsolved bombing case, and we want to know who bombed Judy Barry, and we think that this movie can help inspire a new generation to demand justice in this case.
What were the multiple struggles, and I say multiple struggles, in making this film?
Mary Liz, you want to start with that?
Well, part of one of the struggles was that there was most of the footage we use is archival footage, and it was spread out all over the place in the hands of a variety of videographers who had been following Daryl and Judy for years. So we had to find it and go around and collect it and make it into a digital format from all the old formats. And that was both, I mean, we knew where a lot of it was, but it was a great discovery process to find more. And there was just an amazing amount of footage to work with. And some of it's mine and Tim Pearson as well, who shot at the time. And it was pretty amazing. We also went to the Willits Museum, where the bombed car is still there. And so the research was pretty intense.
And then, of course, the
sound quality was a real bear to handle, and it was actually Skywalker Sound, as in George Lucas in Star Wars. It was Skywalker Sound who donated their studios to us to try to get some kind of, you know, equilibrium on the sound so it was, you know, listenable. I mean, it was all listenable, but there was tape hiss, there was, you know, mechanical noises. So these were just some of the struggles. There was over 250 contracts we had to sign just to get, you know, musical releases and video releases. So, and then, you know, probably, but believe it or not, I think probably the least struggle we had was actually telling the story. Because guess what? Judy Barry is a magnificent storyteller. Yeah. And so we simply allowed her to guide the movie along.
All right, Liz, first of all, just to get a little bit more from you, when you say archival footage, when we're talking about archival footage, you mentioned that it was footage taken at the time. It was, you were there on the ground, and the stuff that you were filming had a lot to do with all the actions of Earth First, correct?
That's correct, yes. Yes, myself and Tim Pearson were in San Francisco the day of the bombing, and we took some Betacam cameras out and just started filming right then, and we were able to interview Judy in the hospital later, and we went up to Redwood Summer, and we did a short that was nationally broadcast on PBS at the time and used for Redwood Summer. So a lot of the footage, when I say archival, we didn't shoot a lot of new stuff of people talking about the past. It's we take you there, so... You know, all of Daryl's reasons are great, but it's also just an amazing story. And so you learn from it all these things, but it's also the kind of story that you can get deep in, that you can really get to know a character who is an amazing person and who stands up for something, you know, Judy and Daryl.
All right, Daryl, so, let me ask you to talk a little bit about Judy Barry, and let's go back, because I'm sure there are many people who don't know much about this story and who were maybe born after the bombing. How did you meet Judy Barry, and tell us why you found this woman captivating and inspirational?
Well, I was running for Congress in the Democratic primary in the first district up in Mendocino, Humboldt counties, and in 1988, and I was trying to design my brochure, and I'm terrible with graphic design, and Betty Ball, the founder of the Mendocino Environmental Center, said, "Hey, I know a great graphic artist. Their name is Judy Barry, and oh, here she comes now," and in blew Judy like a gust of wind into the doors of the Mendocino Environmental Center, and she immediately agreed to help me with my graphic design. And as she laid out my brochure for Congress perfectly, she was ridiculing my run for Congress, just ripping me to shreds, telling me I belonged in a tree, not on Capitol Hill, and that, you know, working through the system does absolutely no good. And I just fell in love with her that minute. It was.
And she, of course, she was many things, including an organizer for the Wobblies.
Yes, Judy Barry was a magnificent organizer. She could bring thousands of people together. She could raise a whole lot of money. She could write and sing songs and play the fiddle. She was a labor organizer who had led two strikes in the East Coast at the Bulk Mail Center at the United States Post Office in Washington, D.C., and the Retail Clerks Union in Maryland.
Some of that background in our movie, too, so you get a sense of where she came from and how that worked, applying that in the Redwoods. I mean, she could talk to loggers like nobody else. She was so good.
Well, and that, of course, was why she was so dangerous, because she was so good, and she could get down with loggers and get their attention.
She was a world-class bridge builder. And during the opening arguments of our eventual lawsuit with the FBI, and the cameras were not allowed in the courtroom, but one of the things Dennis Cunningham, the lead attorney, said was, do not underestimate the significance and power of this woman, in as much as it would warrant her being subject to an assassination attempt. Don't underestimate it. She was astoundingly powerful, and that kind of power, powerful person, only comes along once in a blue moon, and that's why we made a movie about her.
Liz, how did you first hear about Judy Barry? How did you first meet her?
I was doing a lot of video activism in the Bay Area and working with different groups, Rainforest Action Network, and someone else who was involved with the Wobblies. And they brought Daryl and Judy to a house I lived in, a big collective house in San Francisco. And they did a performance and were down there letting people know what was happening with the Redwoods. And so I knew them before the bombing went off. So when it did happen, it was just chilling, you know. We just knew these people were taken down for speaking out, and I'll never forget that day in San Francisco. So,
which is ironically or justifiably where we're premiering our movie on March 2nd at the San Francisco Green Film Festival. So it's all coming back.
That's the voice of Daryl Cherney. Also on the line, along with Daryl Cherney, is filmmaker Mary Liz Thompson. Together, they have a brand new film out. It's going to be shown, premiered this Friday in San Francisco. Who Bombed Judy Barry? Produced by Daryl and Liz. As I said, let's. We've got a little bit of sound from the film, so let's give a listen before we continue our discussion on this marvelous film. I saw it in the works. I was at many different sort of corners as the film moved along. It was an honor to see it coming along, and boy, I am delighted to see that it is available now. But let's listen to some of the sound.
The unofficial word is the two environmentalists injured when a bomb went off in their car just before noon are suspects and not just victims. The unconfirmed report says Judy Barry and Daryl Cherney will be charged with possession and transportation of explosives.
I think we need to stay here so that our children can have wood to build out of. We're not saying no, Logan.
What is the basic event out of which the case arose?
I was bombed and nearly killed in a car bomb assassination attempt. There was a very huge explosion, and I felt it rip through me.
Police say their evidence is compelling, but they would not say what it is.
Of course, the nails didn't match either. They went into my house and pulled nails out of the window trim. This is not your normal investigation where they're trying to find out who did something. They were just trying to frame me.
Terrorists is all they are. They go blowing up stuff. They caught him down Frisco with the bomb.
Our struggle to save these forests has been a trail of tears and broken trees. We've put, quote unquote, the best forestry laws in the country on the books. We've done everything we can to enforce them, and they still take every tree in the forest.
What was it you hoped to achieve by pursuing the lawsuit?
Justice. Justice and vindication.
It was an emotional day in the courtroom today in the case of Earth First activists Judy Barry and Daryl Cherney versus the FBI and Oakland police.
People can see when activists are attacked for their activism by the government, by the police.
what the FBI has been doing instead of fighting terrorism is looking at activists and tampering with activists' protected activities. I mean, that's got to stop.
The question I get asked a lot is, do you think the FBI was involved in the bombing somehow? And I would say they were involved in the bombing right up to the present moment by hiding the identity of the bomber. They're running cover for the bomber, and they're doing it right to this moment.
And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're speaking with Daryl Cherney, and also the co-filmmaker, shall we say, director Liz, Mary Liz Thompson. Together they have put together the film Who Bombed Judy Berry. It's going to be showing Friday at the Green Film Festival in San Francisco, and we'll give you more about that and more in terms of finding out how to learn more about the film and participate in other showings and helping to get the word out. On the line is Daryl Cherney. I have to say, Daryl, I'm like, I'm not tongue-tied, but when I think about this and I think about the whole curve of the story, I'm almost, she was mesmerizing. What happened to her was extraordinary. Most extraordinary was, as you say, the narration, essentially, the connecting tissue really was Judy Berry on her deathbed refusing pain-killing medication in order to remain clear and give the deposition that led to the landmark case in which the FBI and the Oakland Police Department were found liable for millions of dollars for essentially blaming the victim, blaming them from Daryl and Judy for bombing themselves. Let's talk a little bit about that deposition and how that became the narration, if you will, or the connecting tissue. Remind people what happened.
Well, I've always been not a fan of narrators in documentaries. And in fact, not only is this film, you know, all archival, there is nobody in the present being interviewed looking back on the past. And I think that gives the film a sense of being in the now, being there on the scene. So with Judy Berry's deposition, there she is with 30 days left to live. Under questioning from Dennis Cunningham. Dennis Cunningham is the co-star of the movie. He's off screen, but his voice is always there asking the right questions. There's Judy giving nothing less than a heroic performance, under incredible stress. And what's particularly heroic about this is that she knows that she's not going to live to see what the victory or the results of her labor. Now, somebody once said to me that if you're really an activist in this world, you know that whatever you're working for, you're not going to really be able to live to see the results of, you know, ultimately into the future. And Judy epitomized that selflessness and that heroism. And it is very clearly, you know, the power for which she speaks, even when she cries, when she talks about her children and having their house searched a second time and the fear of being in prison while her children were growing up and not being able to watch them grow and bringing her to tears in the deposition, all just has this, you know, powerful thing. She doesn't know she's going to be in a movie. This is just real raw Judy Berry, real raw activism at its core and at its finest.
All right. I want to bring Karen Pickett into the discussion. Karen Pickett was a longtime friend of Judy Berry, a member of Earth First, and one of the first people, after you and Judy were bombed, Daryl, Karen was trying to figure out what the heck was going on. Karen, welcome to Flashpoints. Welcome back.
Thanks, Dennis.
Well, you can lean in there, and maybe what I'd like you to do is just talk a little bit about Judy, how you met her, and what happened with you and to you after the bombing.
Well, I first met Judy in 1988 when she was first getting involved with Earth First. Actually, Daryl brought her as his date to my wedding, but that's a whole other story. But that's when we met, and we became fast friends. You know, we clearly had a lot to talk about, it, even though she was up in Mendocino County and I was in the Bay Area. We were both working on the same issues, and particularly as we were approaching the organizing for Redwood Summer, we talked on the phone all the time. And I was at the Redwood Summer organizing meeting the night before the bombing, and I was also the first person at the hospital. Somebody had called my house. Somebody called the Mendocino Environmental Center with the news of the bombing, and that person called my house, and the person at my house called me at my work at the Ecology Center, and I just dashed out the door. And so when I got to the hospital, even though hundreds of people came very shortly, it was before the crowds were there, and the FBI and the Oakland police approached me as I was trying to find out how badly Judy was hurt. She was in emergency surgery, and they took me downstairs for questioning. And initially, for a very short time, I thought, well, okay, this is what the authorities are supposed to do, right? When a bomb explodes, they're supposed to ask questions. They're supposed to find out what happened. But very quickly, after just a few minutes, I just had this terrible feeling that something was very wrong, something was very fishy in the way that they were conducting themselves. Something horrible had just happened, but there was something very wrong in the way that things were unfolding in the aftermath. And so I didn't answer their questions, and they took me down to the Oakland police station and detained me for several hours. And a funny story in all that is that they made the mistake of locking me in a room at the Oakland police station that had a phone. And even though we knew next to nothing, we knew that the police were not doing their job. And so I picked up the phone and called KPFA News, and they put me on live. And I kind of told the world what had happened and that we needed to rally. You know, we needed to come together, and people just converged. Of course, this was before cell phones and tweets and all of that kind of thing. But so to come around now and have this little piece of history be told the way that it's told, it's, you know, this is a story that's been told so many times. We've had all these panels about COINTELPRO, and we've talked about it a lot over the last 22 years. But to bring it together graphically in this way, the way that the movie is presented is really beautiful, because I think that one of the things that happens with time is that people look back and they think, oh, well, this must be hyperbole. It couldn't have been that bad. But when you hear Judy talking about waking up after extensive surgery, coming out of the anesthesia and seeing cops at the foot of her bed and telling her that she is under arrest. And when you see Judy at the press conference with the police photos showing the hole in the floor under the driver's seat, and then you cut to the police reports with the text highlighted that says they based the arrest warrant on the fact that the bomb exploded in the back seat, and they must have seen it. They must have known it was there, therefore it was their bomb. Then clearly it's not hyperbole. And people need to know this story because it's still going on today.
All right. Let me recap here. We're speaking, that's the voice of Karen Pickett, Earth Firster, friend of the late Judy Berry. A brand new film by Daryl Cherney, and partner, director Mary Liz Thompson, is going to be premiering Friday in San Francisco at the Green Film Festival. For those of you in the Bay Area, that's 1746 Post Street at 5 p.m. We're delighted to have Daryl, to have Liz on the line, and Karen in the studio. Daryl, let me take you back to that moment right after the bombing. Talk a little bit about, you were in the car, you were badly shaken, Judy was, semi-conscious. Talk a little bit about the explosion and what happened right after.
I certainly will, and I just want to remind you and the listeners that our website, whobombedjudybarry.com, can give a lot of information, and it's always J-U-D-I-B-A-R-I. To whobombedjudybarry.com, great place to get our schedule and how to buy tickets. So what happened right after was, first of all, I didn't even know it was a bomb because I had no frame of reference of knowing. And the car came to a kind of a skidding halt, and two kids came out of Oakland High School. It was right at Park and MacArthur, right smack dab in front of Oakland High School. And they came screaming out, it's a bomb, it's a bomb. And that's how I figured it out. But I was treated very rudely by the paramedics who were trying to pull me out. And I told them to take Judy first, and they told me to shut up and to just, you know, listen to what they said. It was very rude, as if somebody had ultimately poisoned their ears and their mind with something about me. I had no idea what was going on except that I was being treated very gruffly. But before I was even pulled out of the car, I just turned to Judy, and this is depicted in the movie, because she said, did Daryl say anything to you? And she says, he told me that he loved me, and he told me I was going to live. And I repeated that to her over and over again to keep her conscious and to also just do everything. The only thing I could do in my power was to try to keep her spirit up and to keep her talking and alive. And so then they was taken to the hospital, to the emergency room, where they pulled glass out of my eyes and stitched up a little bit of my upper eye. And then they said the FBI came in. And they said, what's your name? And for the millionth time, I said, Daryl Cherney. And I said, who are you? And they didn't tell me who they were. They flipped down their little billfolds like they do on TV. And I had a patch on this side. The other eye was pretty closed. And I knew that anybody who would show their badges, anybody who was stupid enough to show their badges to a blind man had to be the FBI. So I immediately, they started. They said, who did this? I gave a laundry list of death threats we had received, and they just waved their hands, and they said, look, we can tell who this is. I'm sorry, we can tell if this is your bomb, so why don't you just confess, get it over with, and make it easy on all of us? And then, of course, like Judy, I asked to see my lawyer. And shortly after that, I was taken out to the Oakland police station. We're coming out of a bombed car. I was put in a cold room with a linoleum floor and hardback chairs and left there for 4 hours or longer before anybody would come to talk to me. I had to beg to go to the bathroom. Beg. I was screaming my bloody butt off, man. I was get me the hell out of here. He needed to go see Judy is what I needed to see. And then they questioned me for 4 hours. And a lot of people say, well, you shouldn't talk to the cops. And I agree. But I am the exception, perhaps, that proves the rule, because I'm pretty good with law, as we found out later. And I talked to them for 4 hours, which at the end of the day was a good thing, because the jury could see that we weren't hiding anything, that we were willing to talk. And there was one point in which I believe it was Lieutenant Sims scratched his head as he was talking to me, and he said, gee, you sure don't fit the profile of a bomber, which I responded, well, no, you know what, Sherlock. And, that was kind of the opening hours. And then in the morning after getting out of a holding cell, they put me into another holding cell, and like Karen Pickett, it had a telephone. And I called KMUD Radio, my own radio, public radio station, and I gave a talk to the people out there, and KPFA was also very instrumental in this case. And in fact, KPFA has two different appearances in our movie, one by Mark Miracle and another more recently by one of your reporters. So all the public radio stations were very helpful in getting the word out and letting us have a voice while we were being oppressed.
All right. Well, here's what we're going to do. We're going to take just a little short break, and we're going to listen to Daryl. I think this is you and Judy singing Judy's song, The FBI Stole My Fiddle. They did take her instrument, right? It was evidence?
Yes, they definitely took her instrument.
Liz?
It was in the car, yeah.
They took it. They never gave it back, and they said it was evidence, and it was her childhood fiddle. She never lived to see it again.
All right, well, let's listen to you and Judy singing "The FBI Stole My Fiddle."
Well, I was driving out of Oakland on a tour for Redwood Summer when a bomb went off inside my car. It was a major bummer. They blamed me for the bomb that almost took my life. But there's one last thing that they did, one last twist of the knife. The FBI stole my fiddle.
They stole my fiddle.
The FBI stole my in the papers, although it made no sense, was a picture of my fiddle and they called it evidence. They took away my Birkenstocks, they took away my car, but when they took my fiddle, well, you know they went too far. The FBI stole my fiddle.
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 William Sessions stole my fiddle. And I want my fiddle back. Was fuses, my bow, it was a lie, and down inside my fiddle hole I stashed my dynamite. So when I stroke my fuse string with my fiddle bow, you better run for cover, cause this fiddle might just blow. The FBI stole my fiddle.
The FBI stole my fiddle.
The FBI stole my fiddle. Agent Richard Held is the man behind the show. He helped frame Leonard Peltier and jail Geronimo. He falsified the evidence, life sentences, no bail. It's time to get the freedom, let's put Richard Held in jail. The FBI stole my fiddle.
Richard Held stole my fiddle.
Judy Berry with Daryl Cherney, The FBI Stole My Fiddle, Irrepressible, the film Who Bombed Judy Berry is premiering, and we're delighted that after a long struggle to make it happen, it did in fact happen. Daryl Cherney and his cohort, the co-filmmaker, Mary Liz Thompson, put this together. And again, I want to tell you, for people in the Bay Area, Friday, 5 p.m. in San Francisco, 1746 Post Street. You can check it out. And there is more information at the website whobombedjudyberry.com. Is that correct?
That's correct. And by the way, the 1746 Post Street is the San Francisco Film Society. They are sponsoring, they're allowing the San Francisco Green Film Festival to have their event at their venue.
All right. Now, the FBI and the Oakland Police Department were clearly culpable. A jury found them liable to the tune of, what, $5 or $6 million?
It was 4.4.
4.4. Let me not exaggerate. But when you're suing the FBI and the Oakland Police Department, you don't usually win. So apparently you had a great case, and with Dennis Cunningham and others, such as Bill Simpich and the other lawyers, you had a great team. And of course, as you say, you had Judy on your side. And Daryl, this wasn't the first attempt to kill Judy Berry, was it?
No. 8 months earlier, Judy Berry and I were driving on Highway 128 toward the coast of Mendocino with Pam Davis from Santa Rosa Earth First and four children, may I say, very young children between the ages of 3 and 8. And a log truck driver rear-ended us while we were on our way. And we had actually stopped for a soda, got back into the car, and we didn't realize the log truck was behind us. But then as we came into Philo, California, this truck rear-ended us, sent us flying into the air. And we came down on a parked pickup truck, took out the porch and the deck of a cafe. And when the truck driver came out, he exclaimed twice, and I heard this with my own two ears, "I didn't see the children. I didn't see the children." Meaning, if he'd seen the children, he might not have tried to rear-end our logging truck. But there was four kids in that car, as well as three adults.
So the truck driver was indicted?
No, the police tried. The CHP tried to blame Judy for getting rear-ended by telling her that her taillights were a little dim, when in fact her taillights had been blown to smithereens by a logging truck. And I actually looked at the police and said, "I was following Judy last night. Her taillights worked fine." And they said, "Well, they were a little dim." So in other words, they tried to blame Judy for getting rear-ended by a logging truck. No indictment occurred.
And this wasn't the only sign that people were unhappy with Judy Berry and what you were doing all working on Earth First, because there were other little notes that would arrive, huh?
Many, many death threats occurred just before Redwood Summer, about a few dozen, three dozen in the period of a month and a half just before Redwood Summer. There was also other violence being engaged upon Earth Firsters up north. A Great King was punched out. A grandmother named Mem Hill was also had her nose broken by a logger. So tension was...
As well as fake press releases trying to stir up violence, saying that Earth First was going to provoke violence. So some of those tactics, one thing that I think is so interesting is just for Occupy Today and other activists, and even with Climate Gate and all the, you know, climate change skeptics and all that, just the onslaught of the fakeness and the attempt to be divisive and stir things up. There's just kind of a lot for people to learn that applies to today too. Same kind of tactics.
And I guess I'm pointing that out, and it becomes very clear in the film that there was every reason for the FBI and the Oakland Police Department to take this as an attempted homicide instead of arresting the bomb victims. And I think that becomes clear in the film, yes?
Yeah, definitely. There were so many death threats and all these other instances where clearly there were plenty of people who could have wanted to do this, to bomb them, and they never followed up on any of them. Nothing.
Well, one of the things we had to prove in the trial, Dennis, was that the FBI lied and knew they were lying. And so that's very difficult to prove, to be able to get into somebody's mind to show that they knew they were lying. But the paper trail and even their own courtroom testimony made it so obvious that they knew they were lying that we won that lawsuit. But the lying was just blatant.
Could you describe, Daryl, the impact Judy's testimony, her posthumous deposition had on the jury?
Well, the jury was left in tears by Judy Berry's deathbed deposition, her deathbed testimony. But there was another component that happened at the very beginning of the trial when the jury was selected. And the jury ultimately wound up being a jury of 10, and there was 8 women and 2 men. And I knew, as soon as I saw that the jury was 80% women, I said, I knew we were going to win, because Judy had a certain resonance with women. She was a radical feminist, but she was a working-class mom, worked as a carpenter, professional carpenter, as well as a sign painter and a graphic designer and other odd jobs. She resonated with women, and it was metaphysical, just about the way she could communicate with women. And so when the jury was 80% women, I knew we were destined to win this case.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. That is the voice of Daryl Cherney. He's joined by Mary Liz Thompson. Together they made the film Who Bombed Judy Berry? And again, it premieres in San Francisco at the San Francisco Green Film Festival at the 1746 Post Street. And it's at the San Francisco Film
Society,
yes. I have to say thank you, Daryl. I'm really glad you made this film. And I think Karen Pickett wants to jump in here.
Well, I'm so glad that this film is finally, that it was made. First of all, thank you, Mary Liz and Daryl. I know it's been a tremendous amount of work on the part of a lot of people, but the fact that it's, you know, passing into the public realm now on a national basis, that's significant in itself, but the timing couldn't be better because, you know, with the Occupy movement has me very excited these days. And I think that there's a lot of parallels that we can see, you know, the cross movement organizing that people are trying to do, in the Occupy movement that is really, making it feel like something that hasn't happened before. There was the same kind of cross-movement organizing that Judy was doing. And I think that the organizing that Judy did and we all did back then and up to present has laid the foundation for a lot of the stuff that's going on in the Occupy movement. And also, you know, the boldness, people just going out into the streets and then counting heads instead of counting heads first and saying, you know, do we have enough people to do this? Should we do this? You just do it. And that's kind of what Redwood Summer was all about. You know, let's just put the call out. And Redwood Summer was essentially Judy's brainchild, and we hadn't done it before. And it was a matter of, you know, looking at this crisis situation and saying, well, let's just take this bold step. You know, let's just get as many people as we can and just do it. And it made a difference.
Daryl, say a little bit more about, and Liz, say a little bit more about Redwood Summer and the significance of this plan to bring large numbers of people in to stand with these extraordinary trees, these ancient survivors that meant so much to so many people and to the whole ecosystem up north. I mean, Judy was perhaps, I mean, she, along with the rest of you, really put this story on the map. And before that, nobody would really be thinking about trees. Who could give a damn about trees and cutting down a few trees? I mean, this was a revolutionary movement.
Yes, and before I get totally dive into that, let me first say that Redwood Summer was based on Freedom Summer in Mississippi and the Deep South in the early 1960s, in which things were so bad for African American people, even to get to the voting booth, especially to get to the voting booth, that they put a call out for Northerners, particularly white Northerners and college kids, to come to the South and draw attention to what was going on down there, because as long as it remained behind the curtain, it could continue. But as soon as you shine the light on it of the public and the media, then change could happen. And to that end, we had a fundraiser in Los Angeles not too long ago, a few weeks ago, and Tom Hayden, who co-hosted the event, brought with him a surprise guest, Charles McDew, the first chairman of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee that founded Freedom Summer in Mississippi. And Charles McDew just gave this lavishly lauding speech of our movie, which we recorded on video and have posted on our Facebook page, Who Bombed Judy Barry. So if you want to see the connection between Freedom Summer in Mississippi and Redwood Summer and the call to bring people in, Charles McDew speaks about that on video. And one of the things he said that was so important.
Liz, yes.
What was great, what he mentioned was how he could see how what they did was a seed that Redwood Summer followed up on, and now, you know, and they're just continuing into the future.
Yeah, what he said, which is basically what Mary Liz said, but a little more in depth, is that they said, if we all die 2 years from now and this movement is dead, at least we planted that seed and others will pick up on it. And then he said, you have you were the seed that we planted. But with Redwood Summer, Judy and I, without realizing what Charles McDew had said back in Freedom Summer, were saying the same thing. And in Judy's speech at the end of our movie, or toward the end, she says, you're going to take this message home and work on whatever issue it is you work on, because it's all one issue, the same issue that rewards Charles Hurwitz while it takes welfare checks away from needy mothers. And so the point is that Redwood Summer was as much about educating and inspiring people as much as it was about the Redwoods. And of course, the Redwoods were and are still very few and far between when it comes to the 2,000-year-old majestic giants that Judy and I and Karen Pickett and Mary Liz and thousands of others felt so passionately about back then as we do today. So the idea was that there's, just as racism exists, there's also speciesism, that there is a discrimination against non-human life forms in this planet, which is a very strong Earth-first tenet, that we need to draw attention to the rights of all species as well as the rights of human beings.
And one of the things true to Judy Berry was that she was a humanitarian, that she did not want to hurt any living being, and she led the fight to come out against tree spiking, right? You want to remind people what that is and what stand she took that didn't win her the allegiance of all the environmentalists.
Go ahead.
Liz?
Well, just that it's an interesting, you know, the Redwood Summer and that movement had to go through some issues that other movements go through, too, and once it got to a bigger level, Judy was a strong force in pushing for a more of a mass nonviolent movement. You have to use civil disobedience in a nonviolent way. And people were so frustrated. They were taking Redwoods out so fast. It was an incredible time when you saw the surge in clear cutting and the huge rapid pace. You know, you can relate to and understand just the frustration and people wanting to use monkey wrenching or sabotage or whatever just to put a stop to it. And she saw that they had to, as a tactic, because one logger was hurt, not by anything Earth First did, but happened from a tree spike. And that was something she realized that it wasn't worth the chance of anyone getting hurt. It wasn't going to save enough trees. And maybe it did save some. I mean, there were areas where tree spiking was really widely applied all over, and it probably did save some trees. But she was a huge force in moving the movement towards declaring, you know, renouncing it.
Well, Judy said that you can't have a movement that espouses sabotage and violence that also prints the names of its contacts in the back page of the newspaper. That and just as I hear Occupy Oakland has issues with violence versus nonviolence, I say, and this is, by the way, on my website, DarylTrini.com, and Daryl's 20 Rules of Activism, if I may make a plug, that violence is a dominant gene. That as soon as somebody brings violence into the movement, then it applies to everybody. And that's not fair to the people who are nonviolent. And so Judy understood the need for a public movement to have a nonviolent position, and also the effectiveness of nonviolence from Dr. King and the civil rights movement to Gandhi and onward, that nonviolence has a proven track record of success, and that's what really counts.
Listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio, I don't want to belabor the point, but if you're in the Bay Area, you will want to be in San Francisco Friday at 5 p.m. On Post Street, 1746 Post Street, to see the premiere, the San Francisco premiere, Who Bombed Judy Berry? It is premiering in San Francisco and Washington on the 2nd and the 4th. But Friday, for all of you who know Judy Berry, who have heard about Judy Berry, and for all of you who never heard the name Judy Berry, even more so, you want to go there. If you want to meet on the screen a visionary, powerful woman who made a big difference in the lives of many people, many women, that would be Judy Berry. Now, Daryl, Judy never could participate in Redwood Summer, but it went ahead.
She actually made it to one demonstration at the San Francisco Federal Building in front of the FBI offices. It was an all-women's rally for Judy. But ultimately, you are correct. The very grand, pinnacle of her organizing at the time, Redwood Summer, she was not able to attend. And how sad is that? You know, but you're correct. She essentially did not participate in Redwood Summer, unless you count the fact that her hospital room was, in a sense, its own organizing office, just filled with people constantly. The hospital just threw their hands up in the air over the two visitor per room position, and there was just always a mob, not just the people in her room, but people sitting outside in the hallways waiting to get in.
Is there a song on the CD from that rally in front of the FBI?
It's actually "Who Bombed Judy Barry" was written for that rally, that is on the CD.
All right, let's cue that up. Let's play a little bit of "Who Bombed Judy Barry" from that rally.
Is a wobbly organizer, a Mother Jones at the Georgia Pacific Mill. She fought for the sawmill workers hit by that PCB spill. G. Marshall Hunt's calling GP shots from Atlanta. Don Nelson sold in the Union long ago. Now they weren't gonna have no wobbly running their logging show. So they spewed out their hatred, and they laid out their scams. Cherry Philbrick called for violence. Was no secret what they planned. So I ask you now, who bombed Judy Barry? I know you're out there still.
Who bombed Judy Barry? And, Daryl, we don't know who bombed Judy Barry, do we? Because the FBI arrested the bomb victims instead of going after the bomber.
Well, they never even conducted as much as a fingerprint comparison, and there were fingerprints to compare. They didn't even compare our fingerprints. There was no investigation of any kind whatsoever. However, 22 years later, we do have a motion in court that we are winning so far to get key evidence returned to us that has potential DNA and fingerprints on an partially exploded, essentially an unexploded bomb that was made by the same bomber who bombed Judy Barry's car. 2 weeks earlier, a bomb had gone off at a sawmill in Cloverdale, and then a letter writer came and took credit not just for the bomb in Judy's car, but for a bomb that was put at the Cloverdale Mill, in which he said he was trying to frame Judy Barry. The point is that bomb, very much intact because it was a dud, has never been tested for fingerprints or DNA. The court ordered back in January of last year, of 2011, for the FBI to turn it over to an independent forensic laboratory, as directed by us, our side. And the judge, it's been appealed, and the judge who's listening to the appeal has waited over a year, has said nothing. And we are filing here. Janice, you're getting the news story first. We are filing a motion tomorrow to wake this case back up and ask the judge to order this evidence turned over to an independent lab so we can at least get a fingerprint and or DNA identity of the person who bombed us.
And for some reason, the FBI and the feds wanted to get rid of all the evidence.
They want to incinerate it. And by the way, we do have DNA off of the letter that took credit, off of the postage stamp and the licked envelope, and that DNA happens to be that of an unidentified female. Very interesting. Makes you wonder if the bomber didn't have a secretary. So if the DNA on the bomb turns out to be male, even if it's an unknown male, then we have a conspiracy, a woman and a man involved in the bombing, not just one person. But we don't know yet.
Yeah.
And you have to also wonder, you know, why the FBI wants to get rid of the rest of the evidence, why they don't want to turn it over. Why do they care? Why are they putting up a fight and this challenge? And, you know, the on the anniversaries of the bombings. We go to the bombing site here in the Bay Area. I do, and a handful of other people every year to mark the moment. And we take a banner that is a depiction of Judy with her fist raised in front of the FBI building. And it says, "Don't ever give up." And that's, you know, that's part of the message here. Don't ever forget. And don't ever give up. And I think that part of the function of this movie, this film, too, is to be part of the investigation. Because the more people that are talking about it, you know, this is how crimes are solved. This is how investigation is being done when it's not being done by police agencies, but it's being done by the people. And like what we had back then, the Wobbly Bureau of Investigation. And I think that one lesson from the trial, from the last 22 years, from Judy's strategy, is that you can always stand up to that power, no matter how powerful it seems. And, you know, she said in the movie too that the reason, you know, it's not enough to be right. And it's not enough to be innocent, and that she had a fear of spending the rest of her life in jail, even though she was innocent, particularly when it was revealed very early on that Richard Held from the FBI was heading up the investigation and behind all of this, because he was the same COINTELPRO operative at the FBI that had waged campaigns against the American Indian Movement and the Black Panthers and the Puerto Rican Independentistas. And, you know, it reminds me of the Homeland Security issuing orders to the Oakland Police Department about how to carry out their business. It's overwhelming, but we can always fight back. We can always stand up to that power strategically.
Okay, we only have about 2 minutes left, and I want to give first you, Mary Liz Thompson, and then you, Daryl, why this film was important for you to make. Let me start with you, Mary Liz.
Well, I think a lot of people have a really vague idea that somehow the Redwoods were saved, and they don't really have any sense of what that took and who did it. And I think it's an amazing American story, an amazing global story of these people who, like Karen said, stood up to power. And I think that's just, it's a powerful thing to see that in action. I think people will love seeing the story.
Daryl.
The original reason we started working on a film was actually to make a dramatic feature with a screenplay. And when two screenplays later we hadn't quite succeeded, we converted to making a documentary. But Hollywood had been actually deluging us with offers to make this movie, and they all seemed kind of sleazy, if I may say so. So part of making this movie was about making the movie ourselves. And after we weren't able to do it with a script, we moved to the documentary format. But to repeat what Mary Liz essentially said, this is a movie about victory. And I think we need more of that in this world.
All right. Well, Daryl, Mary Liz Thompson, and all the people who worked on this film, I congratulate you. I urge people to check it out if they want to be inspired again and meet somebody on the screen who can change your life. She certainly changed mine, and I know I'm not alone. The film, again, is Who Bombed Judy Berry, Friday. Let me belabor the point. Friday, 5 o'clock in San Francisco, 1746 Post Street. You want to check it out for the West Coast premiere at the San Francisco Green Festival. Daryl, Mary Liz, Karen Pickett.
And people should get advance tickets too.
Yes, on the SF Green, is sfgreenfilmfestival.com or .org, I forget which, but go to San Francisco Green Film Festival. Buy your tickets. There's only 143 seats in the auditorium. It's going to sell out.
All right. Well, thank all of you. More to come. I'm Dennis Bernstein for the Flashpoints team, and we're out of here.
Thank you, Dennis. Viva Judy.
Thank you.
Thank
Viva
you.
Judy.
Judy Berry is a wobbly organizer, a Mother Jones at the Georgia Pacific Mill. She fought for the sawmill workers. hit by that PCB spill. Marshall Hunt's calling GP shots from Atlanta. Don Nelson sold in the Union long ago. Now they weren't gonna have no Wobbly running their logging show. So they spewed out their hatred and they laid out their scam.
If you want somebody here on TwitWit Radio to insert your TwitWit into the conversation, tweet it now. And whenever you hear this sound, we're speaking your words. I see some TwitWit now.
From Berkeley, it's TwitWit Radio. Social media on the air.
It's like you get to be the playwrights, only you don't get to write the whole play, you only get to write some of the play. My name is Berkeley Kidd, and I'll be keeping score.
Sundays at 7 o'clock p.m.
And the actors say or sing and make speeches using your tweets.
Is it a crime to survive on 98th Street? No, it's a miracle.
The main rule is to break every rule for comic effect.
Post TwitWit on the topics and targets
at kpfa.twitwitradio.com.
Responsible anarchy.
And
94.1 FM. Sunday nights at 7.